Tanya Plibersek is one of Australia's best-known politicians. She entered Parliament in 1998 and has served in a range of ministerial portfolios, including as Minister for the Status of Women, Minister for Housing, Minister for Social Inclusion, Minister for Human Services, Minister for Health, and now as Australia's Minister for the Environment and Water. But because this is a podcast which is free of politics or policy, we won't be talking today about Tanya's extraordinary policy achievements, nor about her views on Australian politics today. Instead, we'll be focusing on her reading life, and in particular, on her love of detective fiction. Tanya is a kind and generous colleague, fun and thoughtful, and I hope you'll get a sense today of how important reading is to her and how detective fiction helped shape her life. Tanya Plibersek, welcome to the Good Life Podcast. So, how did you first get into detective fiction? Was this a genre you enjoyed as a child? Because I've got to say, this is not my natural genre, and I had to do an inordinate amount of preparation for today's podcast conversation.
So, actually, as a child, as a pretty young kid, like 10 years old, I started reading Agatha Christie. I always really enjoyed Agatha Christie. At that age, I was reading a lot of James Herriot books about being a vet and obviously the usual things that kids read as well. But I did have a bit of a thing for Hercule Poirot and Miss Marple back in the day as well. And they're very good books to get kids interested in reading, I think. They're very fast-paced and quite easy to read and quite compelling plot-driven books. So I enjoyed them as a kid. But then actually, I would say I haven't been a lifelong reader of detective novels and spy novels, but I do find them relaxing. When you asked me to talk about books, Andrew, the truth is I really read pretty widely, and this is a subset of what I read. I thought you'd be bored out of your mind if I insisted on talking about Jane Austen or Anthony Trollope and his Palliser series. So I thought, let's go detective fiction.
So I love Austen. I'm less keen on Trollope, but delighted to be diving into...
You can sometimes tell he's paid by the word, can't you? It's like Charles Dickens. I love Dickens, but you can sometimes tell he's paid by the word.
Although there's something about the characters that emerge in that context where you're forced to pause and describe the scene in a little more detail than you would otherwise.
Yeah,
and Dickens' characterisation
is beautiful.
I don't like that.
You know, in Shakespeare, in Midsummer Night's Dream, that aside with the popular mechanicals, I could do without that whole aside. And that's how I feel about Dickens. You'd be rolling along in the plot and then suddenly you're in Australia where, you know, the convict has, you know, there's a whole backstory that really doesn't add that much to the plot, but, you know, it's several weeks worth of periodical that he's filled. Anyway, there you go, asides.
So we've just done one ourselves. So let's dive straight into one of the authors that you recommended to me, Mick Herron, and his Slow Horses series set in Slough House. This I think was one of my favourites. I relished the abrasiveness of the characters, that sort of the dark British humour. The echoes of the Cold War. I worked in London for a period in the mid 1990s. It evoked that sense of lonely midwinter London, which I really think of as a characteristic of so many of the novels. So, talk us through Mick Herron and what you like about him.
Well, I think if anybody's seen any of the Slough House series or the Slow Horses series on TV, the books are even better than the TV show. And the TV show is one of the best things I've watched on television in years. The main character that, you know, runs this little ring of disgraced spies who are banished to Slough House, played by Gary Oldman in the TV series, is just the most offensive human being. He's rude, he's sexist, he's racist, his personal hygiene leaves a lot to be desired. And yet, beneath it all, you can tell he was an excellent spy at the top of his game in East Germany before the wall came down. And he has the ability to protect his team and the loyalty to protect his team, even though they're, you know, a bedraggled bunch of misfits. I think the books are incredibly, as you say, evocative, but the plots are really, they're complex, interesting, imaginative plots as well. I think a lot of spy novels and detective novels are quite formulaic. So a person hits on a formula that sells well and they will write 30 books with the same characters and the plots are minor variations on a theme. The Slough House books are not like that.
Dead Lions, I found, are just a brilliant plot and the way it wrapped together. I just couldn't stop consuming it.
And I like the fact, and a couple of the other writers, like we'll talk in a minute about Philip Kerr's series on Bernie Gunter. I like the flashbacks to pre the wall coming down, East Germany in the Slow Horses books and in Bernie Gunter the flashbacks to pre-Second World War, Germany and Austria. It's a little taste of Cold War history in the case of Slow Horses that you get through your fiction. That I just find that a really appealing part of fiction, a little bit of history along the way.
And there's these moments in it which sort of felt extraordinarily real to the world we live in. I remember one line, don't knock cipher clerks. Like everyone else in the civil service, all the work is done at the bottom of the food chain. Everyone else just has meetings.
That's so true.
And there's this sense, there's another beautiful line where he writes, the fresh cigarette smoke pushed the stale cigarette smoke for the room, which feels so reminiscent of London for so much of its history.
Yeah, both in the TV series and in the books, you can almost smell what's going on in them.
Yes. And how do you think it works in terms of the contrast between personal... you talked about personal hygiene, personal character, but the sort of deep morality. There feels like there's a bit of a tension in Jackson Lamb in particular.
So I think this is one of the things that I like about a number of the central characters of the books that we'll discuss. I am attracted to main characters who have a strong sense of right and wrong and are prepared to sacrifice in order to act in a way that they believe is ethical. And Jackson Lamb is a character that hides that really well. You know, he is deliberately cynical and deliberately unpleasant and deliberately difficult to work with, but underneath it would die to protect the people that rely on him. I find that core of morality, well disguised in his case, a very appealing character trait.
So let's move from Mick Herron on to Philip Kerr and his Bernie Gunter series. This one I found harder to get into. There was a sense of kind of casting back to World War II, which I didn't find grab me as much. But I see as soon as I walked into your office, you had Field Grey, number 7 in the series, and Philip Kerr's obviously someone who's captured you. Well, what do you enjoy about that series?
Yes, I actually it is Filgrave's on my desk because I tried to get someone I work with to read it and he brought it back unread. So you and Dave have a similar taste in books. I love this series of books. And again, it's because I feel like I am transported back to, in the case of Bernie Gunter, really the book's earliest plot lines start before the Second World War, in the sort of mid-30s, Weimar Republic. And again, Bernie Gunter, he's a bit of a classic, kind of almost stereotypical, hard drinking, hard living, heart of gold kind of character. But there's two things that I particularly like about these books. I think the world that Philip Kerr creates, the picture that he draws of the Weimar Republic, of the you know, living in Berlin during the rise of National Socialism, working as a police officer through the war, and afterwards being, probably don't want to give away too much about the long arc of the plot, but what happens to Bernie Gunter after the war. Each period is incredibly well drawn, and I feel like I can picture that world. The detail of the hotel where Bernie Gunter becomes the hotel detective for a time, the detail of what it's like to work in a police force for a government that you can't respect, and how you, so there's the really specific details of what life was like, the struggle to get food, the interference with your work, springtime in Berlin, what was it like? That's really vivid for me. But the thing that I particularly like about these novels are the moral quandary of how do you, as a supporter of democracy, behave in a world that is increasingly anti-democratic and totalitarian? How much would you do to save your own skin? What would you do to survive, to get through to the other side of the war? What chances would you take to protect others? I think these sort of moral questions of how ordinary people behave at extraordinary times are really interesting to examine. And thinking about how you would behave in a world that was hostile to all of your values, what would you do to get through? Would you sacrifice yourself early on?
Yeah.
These things are really interesting to contemplate.
Philip Kerr also creates a whole lot of different worlds. The books aren't just located in a single place. You've got Vienna, you've got Argentina, you've got Cuba.
French Riviera.
His ability to create new contexts strikes me as quite different from some of the other detective novelists we'll talk about, who are much more fixed to a single place.
Absolutely. And, you know, when he's describing the best hotel in Berlin, you can really picture what it was like. Well, one of the things I like about Philip Kerr, actually, is the way that he knits together the sort of places that you're describing, the French Riviera and so on, Vienna, and the time that his character is living in, with real bits of history. So, of course, there's one, Prague Fatale, which is set in Prague in September 1941. And he has been sent to Prague to work for Reinhard Heydrich. And the knitting together of a kind of mystery set at the time that is not, you know, not based on any particular historical incident, with the assassination that is a real historical event. I think it's a really nice device to set a fictional character in the centre of a real event, a fictional character that you have some sympathy with, and to try and look at that historical event through the eyes of the fictional character.
Do you find yourself changed in how you approach a day after you've been reading a Philip Kerr novel? Does the bravery or the lack of bravery of a character shape your choices during the day, or is this pure kind of escapism?
No, it's absolutely pure escapism. What it does is make me read more about the history of the time and place sometimes. So, for example, after reading Prague Fatale, I read HHHH, which is it's a historical account of the assassination of Heydrich and the capture of the paratroopers who were behind it. And so I think this sort of historical fiction can be a good way of getting people interested in fiction. I always encourage my kids to read these books because it's a sort of easy start on history for them.
And possibly the most similar of the detective novelists that you suggested we talk about today is Alan First, who's...
God, he's a beautiful writer. I really... Again, you feel like you're in Paris in 1939 when you read these books. I love them. The one that I particularly enjoyed of all of them, if I had to pick one, is Night Soldiers, where it sort of starts in Bulgaria in 1934 and a young man is murdered by local fascists, and his brother is... sort of escaping from the fascist. He's recruited by the NKVD, the Soviet Secret Intelligence, and it goes through the training he does to become a spy. It really kind of, in a quite detailed way, describes how the NKVD used to train people, and then he gets sent to Spain to infiltrate, one of the battalions there. It is so interesting. The training process for the spy is so interesting. Mm. What it was like to fight during the Spanish Civil War, so interesting. But the whole series of books is not just fascinating for the kind of, you know, historical settings, but so beautifully written. Although, again, I mean, it's interesting because... the three kind of real main characters we've described, the Jackson Lamb, Bernie Gunter, and the, you know, main sort of characters in the Alan First books are kind of quite classic, hard-bitten, hard-drinking, hard-living detective characters. But some of the other books I like, the Armand Gamache series by Louise Penny and the Guido Brunetti series by Donna Leon, they're very, very different main characters. They're very gentle and kind of cultured detectives. And I think it is, it is interesting to overturn that real... I mean, it is a cliche, isn't it? The hard-bitten detective, hard-drinking with a heart of gold. It is a cliche, but it's nevertheless, in the Alan First books, there's scenes set in, you know, tiny little attic rooms on creaky beds with thin mattresses, not much food. You're lucky if you get a bottle of red wine and a bit of cheese. I can so picture that from the writing. It's incredible.
And Night Soldiers, as you mentioned before, that touching on the Spanish Civil War I find fascinating. I mean, a lot of listeners will have read George Orwell's Homage to Catalonia or Anna Funda's Wifedom, and had that sense of betrayal within a movement. And so then to have a central character who themselves is trying to bring about betrayal, I think, helps to unfold one of the most fascinating conflicts in history.
They're both actually great books, Orwell and Anna Funda's take on Orwell. And doesn't he come out of that badly?
I had no idea about the affairs.
And what an arsehole he was. Well, I mean, further proof, really, that plenty of people who are great creative geniuses are horrible to the women in their lives. Orwell's a good example. Pablo Picasso, a violent brute.
Yes. Is there anything else on the later Alan First books? I mean, it does strike me both Philip Kerr and Alan First, interestingly, start to write just around the time the Berlin Wall is coming down and communism's collapsing. So, March Violets, Philip Kerr's first, is 1989. Night Soldiers, that you mentioned before, from Alan First, is 1988. And they're both writing through this period of the collapse of the old Soviet empire. Do you think there's something about that context which shapes their books?
Look, I don't know. This is just a guess. But I sort of remember at that time a lot of the record keeping, the meticulous record keeping of the Stasi, for example, gave us a real insight into the level of, as you say, betrayal and spying that was going on in everyday life. And you mentioned Anna Funda, her book Stasiland is, yes, a really terrific, I mean, you'd almost say expose of the way neighbours were spying on neighbours in East Germany. I think perhaps the fact that there was so much information coming out about the what was going on for ordinary people during the decades of the Cold War, it probably influenced some of the writing here. It certainly gave some context.
So let's move on to Donna Leon, who is an American author whose books are set in Venice through the Commissario Guido Brunetti. We get an extraordinary amount of detail about Brunetti's clothing, about his bearings. What is it you like about Donna Leon's series?
I like Guido Brunetti. I like the fact that he loves his wife and children and goes home for dinner and reads lots of history and is a decent man and, loves good food and wine and culture. But more particularly, I love the setting in Venice. I mean, you talk about escapism. What is more beautiful than reading about a lovely meal on a balcony overlooking the city of Venice at sunset? I could just read the descriptions of the meals that he has with his wife. I love Venice. As I've been there probably three times in my life, and I love escaping back to Venice through these books. I would say this is one of those series where the author's kind of hit on a formula that works, and she goes back to the same formula. So I think if you read a dozen of these, you've probably read all 30 of them, and there's a lot of them. But I love the descriptions of the houses, the food, how he gets to work, how he travels about in the police launch, the old buildings that he has to go into to interview people, the crumbling sort of waterfront palazzos. I love the descriptions of place that include details like, you know, food and art and so on. And she she really is very convincing in creating a sense of place.
It's also not uncritical about Venetian society. Thinking about Dressed for Death, which is about the death of a transvestite and has a lot about the anti-LGBT plus attitudes, particularly of the Venetian blokes.
Well, I think it's critical in lots of ways. Yes, it uncovers some of those prejudices, but she really has almost in every book there is a main plot or a subplot about corruption, whether it's the corruption of the city officials, whether it's corruption of the national government, links of between the government and the mafia, links between the mafia and the church. It is very focused on issues of corruption. Illegal dumping of chemicals or waste is a big feature in this. Release of pollution into waterways and the air. She has a lot of focus on that corruption. And that's, I mean, it go a little bit back to the sort of Bernie Gunter. How do you, as a Democrat and someone who believes in human rights, survive in a government run by the Nazis? Brunetti's a similar sort of character. How does someone who is a fundamentally decent and honourable person survive in an environment where there is so much corruption? And how much do you have to kind of play the game to, his objective is to find who murdered that transvestite, for example. Wend your way through the corruption rather than taking it front on, because your objective is not to fix the corruption, your objective is to find the murderer. And so, again, there are lots of little moral and ethical questions posed during the course of the novels that are kind of an interesting intellectual exercise. What would I do in this circumstance?
And it beautifully captures Italian bureaucracy. I remember there's a lovely moment of they send tests down to Rome, and one detective says to the other, "So, do you know someone in Rome that can get this sped up?" And he says, "No, my person's gone." "No, my person's gone too." "Oh, well, I guess we just have to wait 3 weeks."
Yeah. There's a lot of description of that sort of minor corruption, and it's almost... You almost admire some of the people who are engaging in it. The chief of police has a secretary in who is quite a significant character in most of the novels that Brunetti is friends with, and she's forever breaking into or getting friends who are hackers to break into, you know, the bank computer system to get information for Brunetti. She's got a standing order with the best florist in Venice to bring flowers to the police headquarters for her desk at an exorbitant cost. Nobody ever challenges how she's managing to get flowers and glossy magazines delivered to the office on the work account. There's a lot of that sort of minor corruption that you almost respond to as an endearing character trait in these people, which of course it's not. You know, of course it's a terrible thing that there's so much chipping away at the edges of propriety. But in the context, when so many people are behaving so badly and doing things that are so much worse, you kind of understand why the Venetians are shrugging their shoulders, and you end up shrugging your shoulders as well.
One of the things I find fascinating about Donna Leon is her books have been translated into a host of languages, but not Italian, because she says she wants to still be able to travel to Italy and therefore wants not to be recognised.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's very interesting. I don't think Donna Leon is her real name either. So she's probably turning up with a passport and a completely other name. I would want to, if I were her, I would want to be able to go to Venice and keep going back to Venice. You would really do anything to protect your ability to do that. She obviously loves the place. Well, Well, one of the other interesting things is she talks a lot about, or the characters talk a lot about the impact of tourism on Venice. You alluded to it briefly. She talks about the big cruise ships and the flooding of tourists and how hard it is for the city to cope. She talks about the fact that the Venetian population has shrunk to a fraction of what it once was because so many people are Airbnb-ing their Venetian apartment or palazzo. It's so lucrative to rent out the places that people used to live in, that the permanent population has fallen off a cliff. I think it's a great opportunity for people to think about, you know, that impact of tourism on, you know, one of the jewels of the world. And it makes me feel slightly guilty too, because I obviously have loved going there on holidays, but you think about the impact of the loving a place too much. Too many people loving a place, perhaps.
Yes, and the detectives who say that their parents used to live there for generations, but they can no longer afford a place.
That's right.
So they need to commute in. So then there's Louise Penny's series, following Inspector Armand Garnache in the village of Three Pines in Quebec. This series has such a beautiful conception of place because it's a small village. You have Francophone Canada, and the city or the village unfurls novel to novel. Tell us what drew you to Louise Penny.
Well, she creates a really strong sense of place, as you say, not just of Three Pines, but of Quebec. And I really enjoy Armand Garnache as a character. He's a Francophone, but he learnt English at Cambridge, I think, so he can speak either language perfectly. He, again, is a very cultured man who is very moral and ethical, loves his wife and children, tries to do the right thing, faces corruption within the police force, as well as the you know, novel to novel, there is a problem to solve, but then there's an underlying theme of corruption in the police force as well that goes on the long sort of arc of all of the novels. This series gets a tiny bit crazy towards the end. There's a sort of plot element to it that I won't go into, that I found a little far-fetched towards the end. But by that time, I was so much into the world of Three Pines and the characters of Three Pines that I was prepared to put up with the slightly outlandish kind of plot twist at the end. The reason I read these sorts of books is to escape into another world. And that's what Donna Leon does when she's setting up Venice. That's what Louise Penny does when she's setting up Three Pines. And again, I mean, I didn't know much about Francophone Canada before I started reading these books. I really feel like I've got a good sense of the separatist movement in Canada now, and the cultural differences, the way that the French speakers feel about the English speakers, the history of the French colonisation compared with the English colonisation. I think it's just another good way to understand a different society. And then, you know, of course, there's the mysteries. They're quite good. Most of the plot lines are quite interesting plot lines. There's a fentanyl plot line that goes through a few of the novels. And I think, you know, we've been so fortunate in Australia to largely avoid the huge impact that fentanyl has had in the US and in Canada. We've got a significant problem with ICE in Australia, but I think, you know, the fentanyl death toll is even a step beyond that horrific kind of toll that ICE has taken in Australia. And having a bit of an insight into, or imagining what that would be like if we had the same sort of fentanyl problem in Australia as they've got in the US and Canada, that's a, I found that an alarming kind of insight into what might be.
Yes, I think I read recently that 2 out of 5 Americans know somebody who's died of an overdose. It's just a remarkable epidemic. But I did love the way also that food and drink permeate the Louise Penny novels. So Inspector Gamache only drinks Tim Horton's coffee when he's on investigation. There's this lovely theme of bringing a brioche along at the beginning. And I laughed out loud. There's a moment where one of the characters is selecting various teas to serve to people, and finally decides, alights on the right tea, saying, "Violent death demanded Earl Grey."
Yeah. Well, there's some great characters in there. There's an artist called Clara who's got, you know, wild hair. It's always got flecks of paint in it. And she's married to another artist, and one of the plots that goes through a number of books is the way that he is jealous of her and undermines her. But you sort of are able to begin to draw that conclusion for yourself in the early depictions of their relationship, and that intensifies through a number of the novels until there's a sort of denouement of that relationship that illustrates that sort of competition, like professional competition within the relationship, and the way that it makes the husband undermine the wife. I thought that was a really interesting thing to portray. There's other characters who, there's a couple who run the bed and breakfast and restaurant in Three Pines, and their relationship, you really see this sort of quite fundamental flaw in one of the men in the relationship that is, you light on it yourself, you feel like you've discovered this flaw. But then she writes the flaw into the plot as the flaw becomes a more dominant element of the character. I don't know. I'm not explaining it very well. You feel like you get to know these people. You feel like you are discovering, you like them at first, and then as you get to know them better, you go, oh, hang on, there's something about this person that's not quite right.
And more so than the other novelist we're talking about this morning, Louise Penny really seems to do family so well. So the complexities and the details and the dysfunctionalities of family is one of the things I loved about her novels.
Well, it's a very good point you make, because Armand Gamache loves his kids, but his kids aren't perfect.
All of us can relate to that. So let's, on a final author, Chris Hammer, an Australian crime fiction author who has a series of books sparking off Chris's terrific career as a journalist. He has journalist Martin Scarsden in his early novels. What do you enjoy about Chris Hammer's books?
Well, Andrew, I have to thank you for putting me onto Chris Hammer. You suggested I read The Seven because it's about water entitlements. And you said the water minister might enjoy a book about water entitlements, which you were quite right. I did. I liked it very much. I like these because they're set in Australia, and I like reading books about Australia. And again, Chris Hammer creates a really strong sense of place. So I've read, I think I've read all of his books now, but the ones that are set in the Riverina and the Barmah Millawa Forest were particularly interesting for me because, of course, they are areas that I'm trying to look after through the implementation of the Murray-Darling Basin Plan. I know it's no politics on this podcast, but having a sort of fictional plot line set in a real landscape that I'm familiar with and love and think is beautiful. That's always really quite a rewarding thing to do. And I think they're good pacey books. I would say that the most of the main characters are flawed main characters, a bit too belligerent, self-harming for their own good, drink too much, have broken relationships. I think that's a really kind of common thing, I think, in most detective type novels, the flawed lead that you identify with and feel sorry for and want the best for. But again, it's the sense of place that keeps me reading, or kept me reading the whole series of his books. And the plot lines are, I think, really interesting, quite twisty plot lines, which I liked.
One of the things I really love about Chris Hammer's books is how they start. So it's almost as though a former journalist has realised that readers have many options. If you don't grab them at the start, they may move on. And so you have Scrubland starting with a priest shooting dead five people from the steps of the church. It's pretty hard to put that novel down after you've read that scene.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I, you're quite right. All of them start with a bang.
Yeah. It's a real skill that he's got. So, Tanya, more broadly, you're an extraordinarily busy cabinet minister. How do you weave reading into your day? When do you read?
I read before I fall asleep, and I can't fall asleep without reading. And the truth is, I mostly read on a Kindle these days, and so I quite often read during the night as well. If I wake up at 3 a.m. with my mind churning, something that I can't stop thinking about, I pick up a bit of detective fiction, read for half an hour and fall asleep again. I love reading. My idea of the perfect holiday is lying on a towel in the shade under a Norfolk pine at the beach on Lord Howe Island, kids in the water or next to me reading. Feel the most indulgent thing in the world is to spend the day reading. I love it.
Do you read fairly fast?
Pretty quickly, yeah. I mean, on holidays, I probably read a book a day.
And do you always read books to the end?
Almost always, but the way that I mostly read now is if someone recommends a book or I hear something that I think sounds like something I'd like to read, I download a sample onto my Kindle, and then if I don't like the sample, I don't buy the book. That's a good way of having, the next book and the next book sort of ready to go, because I ask for recommendations. People tell me great books that they've read, and then I forget the book that I was absolutely determined to read next. I forget the name and the author. So by having a kind of queue of samples, I can very easily select the next read.
Where do you get your ideas as to the next series to read?
From you quite often, Andrew. Thank you very much. You've recommended a few excellent books along the way, including those Chris Hammer books, but not just them. What's that? Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. What was that one?
Gabriel Zevin. Yes.
Fantastic.
My favourite book of last year.
Yeah, I loved that. But you've recommended some great books. And I've got three other friends that are very good at recommending, four other friends, in fact, I've come to think of it. Every time I catch up with these four particular people, I say, what are you reading? Are you reading anything good at the moment? And as soon as they tell me, I've got the Kindle app on my phone, I put it into my Kindle app straight away, and then I read. When I'm ready for the next book, I scroll through those samples and find one that way.
Well, Tanya, let's wrap up with a few questions that I ask all of my interviewees. What advice would you give to your teenage self?
Don't worry about it. I was a very... I was always worried about how life would work out as a teenager. And I think I could have done with relaxing and enjoying the journey a bit more.
What's something you used to believe but no longer do?
I have evolved my thinking on lots of public policy issues over the years, and I think you got to be a dumbass if you don't change your view as you get more information. Perhaps the one that I have most changed my view on, when I worked in domestic violence kind of 30 years ago almost, I used to think that working with perpetrators of violence was a bit of a lost cause. And when there was so little funding for refuges and supports for women and children fleeing violence, I thought the money would be better directed to those supports. I feel these days that we absolutely need to invest more in emergency accommodation, counselling, legal systems that support victims of violence, all of that, but without properly designed and evaluated and evidence-based interventions with perpetrators, we're going to stay in the vicious cycle of violence. So that's probably one example of where I've shifted quite a bit.
When are you most happy?
On that towel under the Norfolk pine next to the water in the shade with a book on Lord Howe Island that I described earlier.
Do you have any guilty pleasures? You don't seem particularly guilty about your love of reading.
Oh no, I love reading, and I think it's one of the things that has added most to my life. It's brought a richness to my life that I can't describe. But guilty pleasures, trash TV. I love a bit.
What are you
trash
watching
TV
at the moment?
Not watching anything particularly trashy at the moment, but what I mean by trash, I mean really trashy, like Dubai Bling and Indian Matchmaker. they are the real guilty pleasures.
What's the most important thing you do to stay physically and mentally healthy?
I do make sure I incorporate exercise in my life. So I go to the gym and do sort of strength training or high intensity interval training once or twice a week at least. And I walk most days, particularly when I'm in Sydney. Michael and I like to go for a walk in the morning, take the dogs for a walk, get a coffee halfway, talk about, you know, life, the universe, everything. And also when we go to the gym, I mostly go when I can with my husband as well, because it kind of doubles couples time with exercise. You get to do a bit of both, to tick off two boxes with one activity.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of The Good Life, Andrew Lee in conversation. We appreciate getting feedback on the podcast, so please leave us a rating or tell a friend about the show. We'll be back with another inspiring guest to discuss living a happier, healthier and more ethical life.
More value on decent behaviour than anything else. But I also had the great pleasure of working for Senator Bruce Childs, who is one of the most ethical, decent, hardworking, lovely, kind people I've ever met in my life. And I worked for him for, I think, about 3 or 4 years, and he taught me a lot about being able to work in what is potentially quite a difficult, sometimes hostile environment, and keeping your humanity while you do it.
Bruce was a beautiful man.
Yeah.
Tanya Plibersek, thank you so much for taking your time to share your wisdom on the Good Life podcast today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks, Andrew.